If you want access to bonus episodes, reading lists for every series of Empire, a chat community, discounts for all the books mentioned in the week's podcast, ad-free listening, and a weekly newsletter, sign up to Empire Club at www.empirepoduk.com.
Welcome to Empire with me, Anita Arnon.
And me, William Drimple.
So this is the shiny second bonus episode, if you like, of what was going to be a series about the Ottoman Empire. But then we stretched because we thought, how can you understand the Ottoman Empire unless you understand the Byzantine Empire that it replaced? And once again, I'm very excited to say, because you love him, obviously you do, it's our inbox is full of Frankopan love. We're joined by Peter Frankopan.
The great Peter Frankopan. And we were talking about Byzantium. And when we left you, the Crusades had begun. And begun this era of conflict between Christianity and Islam, and the Seljuk Turks were pouring into Anatolia. Where do you want to take us next to, Anita?
Can I take you forward a little bit more to the Fourth Crusade of 1204? Because this, you know, we've got this impression here. When you think about the Crusades in Britain, you've got Robin of Locksley and Richard the Lionheart, and they're all going to fight the good fight. And if they're done down, it's because of treachery at home. And yet there is treachery of an epic scale in 1204 that is not really talked about, where it's sort of Christian on Christian. Can you tell us what happens here?
It is talked about a lot in Greece. It's talked a lot in Croatia too. So basically by about the year 1200, you've got crusade fatigue. So there have been too many of these expeditions out to the east. And, you know, Richard the Lionheart, you know, very good looking himself in the mirror, goes out on a sort of year off with King of France and Frederick Barbarossa, who promptly drowns wearing his armour trying to cross the river, you know, because he underestimated, you know, schoolboy error. And, you know, these expeditions are incredibly expensive. You have to tax people to high heaven, and they don't achieve anything apart from sort of films with Anthony Andrews and sort of you know, the idea that somehow these are chivalrous knights rather than they're totally incompetent and useless.
It inspires a lot of English football supporters going to Qatar, it has to be said.
Well, you know, it's an amazing thing. And they're all wearing the Cross of St. George, which is, a knight from southern Turkey. You know, it's sort of amazing. These ideas got brought back. Anyway, that's for another podcast. So by the 1190s, the idea that it should be yet another crusade sounds good on paper, but in practice, people just aren't really interested. So Saladin conquers Jerusalem in 1187. There's what's called the Third Crusade. It depends how you number them, but they're typically called the Third Crusade, with the kings of England, France, and Germany, which achieves very little, huge expense. And then Richard even gets himself locked up by the police, by the Austrians, the same sort of thing. On the way back, a total shambles.
Breathalyzed in Austria.
Breathalyzed, and yeah, exactly right. And then, so less than 10 years afterwards, there's an idea, let's go again. And a couple of chancers go and hire Venice to basically shut down their entire economy for 2 years to build enough ships for the vast numbers of people who are bound to show up for the crack, who then don't. And the Venetians sit there, you know, with their hands on their head going, you know, you're seriously joking, and you're going to pay us what you owe us. You promised us 85,000 silver ducats. And the crusaders are like, we've checked our pockets. We could probably give you about a third. And the Venetians, who are, you know, smart business people, like, you know, our bankers here, they don't really let you write your money off if you can't pay. So the crusaders have another whip round. They go, we found a little bit more, but we're basically not going to eat for a while. And the Venetians say, even that, you're still barely at half of what we're owed. So they say, I'll tell you what, we've got one idea, which is that on your way, we've got some cities on the Dalmatian coast who have been cheeky enough to say that they don't think we're as powerful as we say we are. But if you knock them over or scare the living daylights out of them, you know, we'll give you some credit for that. So the crusaders then go to the city of Zara, which is now Zadar in Croatia, and they line up to attack. And the inhabitants start hanging sheets over the walls with a cross on saying, we're Christians, you've got the wrong, you know, you're miles away from the Holy Land. You know, you've got thousands of nights of sleepless nights.
Jerusalem this way.
But they go in and sack anyway, because the Venetians say, well, this is the price you pay of doing business and getting it wrong. And then that sort of escalates above and beyond. They get the Venetians, or the fleet rather, gets messages from arrivals for the throne in Constantinople, saying, if you come and help sort us out, if I get to the throne, I'll pay you back. And so in 1203, they reach the walls of Constantinople, and one of the guys trying to get hold of the throne, Alexius IV Angelos, so an imperial dynasty, and, you know, the very divided time, sort of think Brexit or think, you know, Trump, you know, lots of people claiming things one way and then the other, huge unpopularity, no one agreeing with each other. Eventually, Alexius IV takes the throne and he says, whoops, I'm afraid, I'm really embarrassing, guys, haven't really got all the cash. So if you could bear with me for a little bit. And the Crusaders go, look, we've all left home. We're on our way to Jerusalem. I've got my wife. I'm like Baldwin of Flanders. Is like super, super interested in his wife. Told her to go meet him in Acre, a landing port for the Holy Land. So she's on her way there. And so the Crusaders go, look, we have enough of this. And they say, we've got the siege engines to take, you know, big cities in the middle, in the Near East. Anyway, let's set them against Constantinople. And so in 1204, they eventually break into the city and they go, there's some version of ballistic. It used to be thought that they went properly ballistic, ransacked everything. There are stories of prostitutes dancing on the altar in Hagia Sophia and the Great Cathedral. You know, clearly the great treasuries are absolutely ransacked. So gold and relics and treasures are all shipped back to Europe in some epic proportions, particularly to Venice. And then the Crusaders think, well, a little bit awkward because we're not quite sure what we should do now. And they say, well, what about if one of us becomes emperor? And the sort of wonderfully named Boniface of Montferrat, who's the kind of prime joker behind the promising the Venetians how many would come, can't really swing it. So they go, well, that guy Baldwin, he seems quite a good guy. And even if he's like, my wife is on her way to, but okay, I'll give it a shot. And so they then divide, they carve up the empire amongst themselves. The Byzantine emperor, as he was, gets pushed out to the city of Nicaea, which people will know as the home of the Nicene Creed. You know, it's a big city in Western Asia Minor, sets up a court there. Another wing sets up itself in Epirus, what's now sort of northwestern Greece and Albania, in a kind of notional empire of Epirus. And this splintering means that there's a kind of Latin core where these guys don't know what they're doing. And the best way you can show that they don't know what they're doing is that they start arguing with each other. Boniface says, well, I want to be the king of Thessaloniki because that's quite a good thing to call myself. And Baldwin is not that keen on it. But they then both have to go and fight against the Bulgarians. The Bulgarians are on the move because the Bulgarians are always on the move. They've got a second empire they've been building. They capture Baldwin in battle and then decapitate him. And they say, well, bully for that. So for the next 50 years, the Latins sit in Constantinople. They don't bother going to Jerusalem. They run the sort of the core of the empire, but they do it incredibly badly. They eventually, like always happens with Europeans, they kind of lose interest. Their sons don't really want to come out and join them unless they get like proper entitles and very cute wives, which are in very short supply. And eventually by 1261, the Byzantines in Nicaea go, I'll tell you what, lads, we'll take it from here. And then we get to the sort of the next act of the Byzantine Empire, of Constantinople back in Roman hands, or as we call them, Byzantine hands.
So, Peter, we've had lots of toing and froings in Byzantium. Meanwhile, in Anatolia, the Seljuks, who've been building up their kingdom very nicely, thank you, in the middle of Anatolia, have their own problems, because in 1243, the Mongols sweep in.
Yeah, so the Mongols are the great empire builders, probably the greatest empire builders in history. So from the late 1100s, Genghis Khan and then his sons are able to bring from the plains of Mongolia basically the entirety, almost entirety of what's now China, right the way through Central Asia. And by 1242, they reach central Hungary, then sweep down through the Dalmatian coast. And at the same time, they have a spur coming through the Middle East towards Byzantium from that direction too. So the Mongols are fantastically able and adept. The problem, I think, is for the Seljuks is that with nomad groupings or mobile groupings, retaining sole power is quite tricky because you need to have the right or level of authority. You don't typically, these societies don't practice primogeniture, where the sort of chinless one, the elder son, always inherits, or the very capable elder son inherits. It's through agreement. So what happens is the Seljuks, or quite often with these confederations, they tend to splinter because second cousins, third cousins have their own sort of ambitions, or they feel thwarted. And so they can be quite fragile. So when the Mongols come, it's not so much that they snooker the Seljuks or put them out of business. It's more that it's a kind of brittle world that's looking for, I suppose, electricity, looking for lightning. And the Mongols, as they come in, the big question is, are they going to be permanent or not? But the more important thing is that for the context of the, particularly the Near and Middle East, is that in 1258, the Mongols sack the city of Baghdad. And according to one of the Ottoman sort of creation stories that's written about 100 years later, that is the very day that Uthman or Usman is born. And Usman is the sort of the father of the Ottoman dynasty. As I said, we know absolutely zero about him. He's probably born at some point in the 1250s. But what he's good at doing, and probably why his name comes from the Arabic Uthman, which means wise, is that he, like the Seljuks and like all successful politicians of all kinds, is very good at striking deals. And he's very good at offering rewards to the right kinds of people at the right kind of time. So he's able to build a small sort of emirate, I suppose we call it, a small sort of little hub into something that's much bigger, and sometimes by accommodation, sometimes by conquests. But one of the things that people think about Osman and his successors quite early on is the idea that they are going to build a great empire. And so the great dream of Osman, which is sort of foundational in the kind of stories of the Ottoman empires, is that he goes to visit the house of a very powerful figure. And he says in his dream, he dreams that a tree sprouts from his navel. And from that tree creates a world that's fully shaded. And from that shade, you find mountains, you find streams, people building gardens, planting orchards, setting up fountains and so on. And he then reports this to the powerful person he's been to see, who says to him, "Oh, thank God, you're the chosen one. From you are going to be the source that grows this great empire. By the way, I've got a daughter literally in the room next door. It would be really great if you would think about connecting with her, because the two of us together, we could get stuck in." And so the Ottomans start to sort of mushroom into a kind of vacuum, into a void. They build into a void where they're able to deliver rewards for an interest group. And then as that acceleration starts to happen, they become more and more powerful. So they're not conquering by having more children. It's not a kind of migration of large numbers of people. It's through very careful choosing battles that you're going to win and then going through those.
I'm fascinated by this, because this sort of dream of Osman, so suddenly you've got a people who believe in a destiny that is preordained. You know, there's a mysticism about it. On the other hand, you've also got the Byzantines, who also believe they are given by God. You know, they've got the mother of God protecting their great wall. They are also destined and protected by the supernatural. How are they reacting to this other prophecy by another God? You know, people of the book, El-Kitab, after all, these are all people of the book, and they've got their prophecy. How is this all working out?
Well, so the Roman sort of imperial structure isn't a expansionist evangelical empire. I mean, there are lots of evangelicals and evangelists who head out into the steppes and head out, in fact, reaching China by the 630s. We find steles or sort of monuments that record the arrival of Christian missionaries. But the Roman Empire isn't in the business of trying to expand its territory to bring about more Christians. The protection of God is to protect them from disaster, rather than to give them the God-given right to be on earth and so on. So the root of the Ottomans is slightly different, insofar as the idea that you're going to inherit and be blessed by the good Lord is slightly different. But the Romans have been in business for 500-700 years by this time. So they sort of have quite a good awareness of what their limitations are, what they're good at. And they're not sitting there around the campfire or in their imperial palace plotting the destruction of great empires far away. They're first of all, keen on stability. They've got a really smart civil service, a foreign office, who can see problems coming. They're very good at gathering information about who's who. They're very good about working out how to invite them to the state visits and, you know, so on. They're very, very good at giving titles. They're very good at working out how to make marriages so you can calm people. And they're very good to know what it is that people actually want. And what people really want is improved quality of life, higher living standards, and more of the good stuff, silks, gold, etc. And if you can keep on providing that, then fine. The problem is for the Roman Empire, as the Ottomans start to rise, is you have the kind of equivalent of our recent, I was going to say dear departed, but certainly our departed Prime Minister Liz Truss, where we have a fiscal event in the kind of late 1200s, where one smart-ass emperor decides that this is the right moment to cut taxes on the rich and to start debasing the currency to make everybody live in the happily ever after. And that suddenly creates very disgruntled extremely pissed off population who think, well, maybe there are other answers, and maybe the fact that we seem to be in what's lurching from one crisis to the next means that maybe this is the kind of the beginning of an end, beginning of the end. And that's I suppose something that we can perhaps relate to today's world too.
Blimey, a fiscal. I didn't know. I had no idea. Sorry, I'm only being just astonished for a second, William.
So the Ottomans now, we have first of all the first generation, after whom the TV show is named, Ertuğrul.
Right.
And Osman is his son. Tell us about those two.
Well, I think you're just as well watching Netflix. I mean, we don't know anything about them. I mean, so it's all projecting backwards. Of course, they're valiant, glorious, wise, clever, you know, good with kids, with pets, etc. I think
nice to grannies.
Nice to grannies, excellent table manners. I think that these are people who are mobile, they're tough, they're hardy, like the Scots. You know, no airs and graces. But having no airs and graces doesn't mean you're not kind, sympathetic, doesn't mean you're not clever, but also doesn't mean you are clever. But it means that you're quite grizzled and you're quite determined. And the key thing is to work out how do you unlock rewards. I mean, so as a good friend of mine, Niccolò di Cosmo, a great scholar of Inner Asia, puts it, is that the function of all nomadic empires is to be constantly generating rewards. You know, you need to be bringing back more and more stuff all the time. So that means that your horizons have to be constantly moving, and the size of your targets needs to be increasing.
And the Ottomans' horizons are definitely expanding at this point. They're moving westwards. They're moving into Bursa. They're moving into the coastline of Bithynia.
Yeah, you take what you're opportunistic. You know, you take as low hanging fruit as you can, which offers little risk, because if you risk everything on one single battle, then you're toast. So in 1331, Nicaea, which, you know, as I mentioned, was the kind of the second home of the Byzantine emperor in his exile from Constantinople, falls to the Ottomans in 1331. And that then becomes a kind of, that's a seminal moment, because Nicaea is the city that controls access through to the coasts, and more or less spells the kind of the end of Roman and Christian rule in Asia Minor in the east. And that then is followed in the next decade by Black Death. And when Black Death comes, you have massive depopulation across all parts of the known world, except possibly not Poland, where we'd see very little mortality from plague. But that demographic shock then plays through at the same time as civil war, another kickoff between who's in charge of the Byzantine Empire in Constantinople. And so that it's a bit like a sugar cube being dissolved. It's one thing goes from worse to worse, which is really bad if you're Byzantine. But that's great if you're on the rise, as the Ottomans are. So the crossover across the Hellespont, across the Dardanelles, into Europe by the 1360s, so about 30 years after Nicaea falls, by the 1360s, you find the Ottomans deep inside the Balkan interior in Philippopolis, modern Plovdiv, and Adrianople, modern Edirne. Yeah.
And they've just gone right round Constantinople.
Yeah.
They've just avoided it.
And gone round it, why? Because it's so fortified, and because it is this place that you can't get to easily, or they're not interested in, there are lower hanging fruit. What is the reason to just ignore it as if it's not there?
Bit of both. I mean, why bother, first of all? I mean, what is it you gain? Second, if you can, you know, round up and sack smaller targets, you're generating those rewards that I mentioned. It doesn't tie up resource and manpower. You have no risk of failure. If you can keep on taking more assets off the emperor, you're reducing his tax that he is able to benefit from, so you weaken him further still. So the throttling effect is quite a successful one. And it's not necessary that you need to knock out every single target you see. Again, I think it's how we think about modern warfare, that you send the army as a kind of line, but leaving pockets, you know, those could last for a very long time. But I mean, as you say, Anita, the city of Constantinople has some of the most epic fortifications of any site in the world. The walls of Theodosius in particular are then refortified by another Comnenian emperor in the 12th century to keep away the Second Crusaders. I mean, it's not quite an impregnable target, despite what happens in 1204, but you need to have a lot of manpower, and you need to have a lot of the right kind of manpower. So I know in your next podcast, you're going to talk about the fall of the city itself, but you need to have the right kind of people with the right kind of equipment. And the Ottomans could put lots of men into the field, but siege warfare is a different thing to winning battles over land. So by the 1360s, 1370s, decisions be made to just move northwards. By 1389, the Battle of Kosovo, almost the entirety of the Serbian aristocracy is knocked out and killed. But 4 years later, basically what's now Bulgaria falls under Ottoman control. And so often that's done through battles, but it's done through accommodation, which is that we'll take over, we'll maybe keep some of your people in place, we'll recognize their titles, maybe even give you tax breaks. But, you know, you now, the person who you're sending your checks to every month is going to be me, not that guy sitting in Constantinople.
So with the Ottomans now becoming the dominant power in the Balkans, I think it's time to take a break.
Welcome back to Empire. So we're in the late 14th century, and am I right in thinking that we now have vampires in this story?
You are.
We needed more texture and excitement. We now have vampires.
We didn't have enough vampires in the first episode of series two. So we are going to start with the greatest vampire of them all, because one of the people who turn up at the Ottoman capital of Bursa at this point is none other than the future Count Dracula, Vlad the Impaler, who comes in the 1420s to Bursa.
Well, I mean, we've talked about taxation. This is bloodsucking of an entirely different type. So, yes, tell me, what is the role of Vlad the young lad, the Impaler? Because he's quite young here. Vlad the Impaler, how does he fit in?
Well, yeah, you know, I think you know, most people don't want to be, you know, most people want what they know. The arrival of a massive juggernaut that's generating power and trying to redistribute everybody's land is not surprisingly not particularly welcomed. And so you've got a choice, which is you stand and fight and you end up being massacred like in Kosovo, which is the kind of the single biggest moment in Serbian history today. You know, I mean, that's why when the breakup of Yugoslavia happened, you know, that's why Kosovo has been such an important part of the last 30, 40 years, because of the historical legacies of huge setbacks and the loss of heartlands and so on. But so Vlad is quite effective at leading resistance in Wallachia, so what's sort of now broadly Western Romania, against Ottoman incursions. But, you know, your luck always runs out at a certain point, either because, you know, you're overwhelmed by numbers or you're sold by members of your own side, or you just have a bad day at the office. And, you know, so Vlad, you know, achieves a certain notoriety here for the way in which he tries to use extreme violence as a way of stopping further incursions and to try to broker a peace agreement.
Extreme violence, in this case, being mass impalement of the Turks.
Well, you know, I think you know, the risk of getting all the people ringing in to complain, you know, I think that violence and military violence is used in a different way in the pre-modern world. You know, we were taught at school that, you know, it's honor and duty to die for your country, line up by machine guns and get mown down by the First World War. But I can promise you, for most of human history, no one went into battle thinking this was a great way to die. Even on Crusades, you know, people who wrote about it said, well, they've gone straight to heaven. But I can promise you, lots of people who did that weren't as convinced, perhaps, as we might be. But I think that in Vlad's case, and it's a sense that the world is changing very dramatically against your beliefs, Christianity, against your way of life. This new world that's emerging from the steppes and via what the rump of the Byzantine Empire, except for Constantinople, suddenly presents quite existential threats about, you know, what does God intend for us? Is it the apocalypse? Are we going to have a second coming? And shouldn't we fight to try to preserve ourselves while we still can stay safe? But, you know, that all goes wrong. I mean, but before Vlad, in 1396, an attempt of a crusade gets going, and they're butchered at Nicopolis in the Balkans.
Nicopolis, the Hungarian armies wiped out.
Yeah. So at that point, it looks to the, you know, the only way the Ottomans get stopped is with a big push by the West to group together, stand up to a big enemy and coordinate. And I suppose if one was being cynical, nobody really bothered. And perhaps even today, you know, despite appearance to the contrary with Ukraine, you know, we're very good at sending messages of support and a bit of, you know, weaponry, but actually leaning in is a different story. So in 1399, the Emperor Manuel II, Palaiologus, a sort of late Byzantine dynasty, thinks, right, well, to hell with this. I can't just send out letters asking for help. I'm going to go and see people all over Europe and try and convince them to send what we need to hold on to the great, to Constantinople, to push back the Muslim Ottoman infidels who are going to tear down not just our world, but trust us, after you, they're going to come from Vienna, they're going to come from Milan, they're going to come north.
He goes to England. He comes and spends Christmas in 1400 at Eltham Palace.
You've got to be patient, will you? I'd say, yes, but first, before he comes to our blessed isles, he goes to places that are important too.
Where else? Where else could be as important as Eltham?
Tell me one place that's better than England. He goes to Milan. He goes to see the King of France. And as you write, as you pray up, he comes to England, arrives in 1400. He hangs out with Henry IV, goes jousting with him. And sort of English commentators are sort of, they get slightly sort of peeved. They think that the Byzantines look down on them because they think the English have got terrible fashion sense.
How could that be true? How could that be true?
Impossible. But one of the most... I don't know whether it's moving, but one of the most telling comments is an English contemporary account who says, this magnificent man with his retinue and amazing kit and, you know, extraordinary dynasty and legacy going back, whatever, is reduced to having to come round the cities of the countries of Europe begging for help. And as night follows day, over the course of the next 30, 40 years, as things become worse and worse and worse, no one sends help, no one sends support, no one sends money. The sag eventually, as we come towards the gallops towards 1453, it's this great Christian city that's sort of left to hang out to dry. You know, the achievements of Justinian, the achievements of the great Macedonians, Knight Keeper of the Phocas, they're all condemned to the dust. And in fact, taking us in a circle to where we started, that's why later historians, Gibbon and onwards, and before and afterwards, talk about the Byzantine Empire in catastrophic terms, because from their point of view, the Byzantines are the great losers in history. Because they're the ones who surrendered Constantinople or gave it up. In fact, the last emperor is killed on his way out trying to defend the city. He's last seen charging at the Ottoman lines. But I think the idea that that Rome came to an end, you know, 1,000 years earlier is much more convenient for Western historians because they think that that's the legacy we really want to claim. You know, Commodus and Russell Crowe and Gladiator and Augustus, not these guys who become Christian and therefore adulterate, you know, they're sort of watering down what it means to be Roman, to be brave. Because they figure the only reason why the Byzantine Emperor must have fallen is because these guys were overcomplicated and too busy praying rather than the nitty-gritty of fighting. But that's absolutely not the case at all.
I mean, just before we actually get to that sort of final climax, if just circling back to 1402, where, you know, the Zelensky figure is going around just begging for help and not getting it. And there's, you know, there are those wonderful descriptions of him and his retinue in white robes looking like a choir of angels appearing and saying, help us, please help us, as if they're their heavenly host. I mean, that Henry IV meeting, there's a beautiful description of them looking divine and yet completely astonishingly beggarly in front of a court that is not nearly as good as them. You know, so all of that is going on. So you've got, you're sort of creeping up to 1402 and they are feeling so much the pressure. So just as it just seems as if everything is going to implode, this tense nervous headache is turning into a migraine, appears on the horizon, Timur, the analgesic for all kinds of terrible headaches. Now, tell us about Timur and tell us why he was so important.
He's the ibuprofen from the Byzantine point of view. So he's the sort of the constructor of the great successor states built by Chinggis Khan and the Chinggisids. Timur is the kind of the probably equal level of empire builder to the great Chinggis Khan himself. And pressure from the east is obviously very good news if you're Byzantine, because you want your opponent and your competitor to be as stretched and as exposed as possible. And in 1402, there's a battle at Ankara where Timur and his men absolutely give a proper thumping to the Ottomans. And that opens opportunities. It probably buys time.
150,000 in Timur's army, elephants spewing Greek fire, and the Sultan bears it, ends up in a cage.
Yeah, the cage, I believe, a Greek fire, that's fine. That's just kind of the type of naphtha that the Greeks have worked out how to use as kind of projectiles. And the numbers, I think, are all you know, take it with a pinch of salt. But I mean, clearly it's a substantial army. And what Timur is interested in doing is making the Ottomans, who are a big target, submit to him. You know, that's what you want. You don't necessarily need to conquer the lands, but you need to know that you're the boss and that the Ottomans are going to be in your pocket.
Take the knee.
Yeah, and pretty much after 1402, immediately afterwards, Timur thinks, right, job done in the West. These guys are a bunch of jokers. They're not a real threat. Now's my time to work, to turn eastwards in towards China, into what's then the Ming Dynasty. And in fact, then dies in 1405, so without quite completing his dreams. That pressure that comes onto the Ottomans from the eastern side is quite helpful for the Byzantines, the Romans in Constantinople, insofar as it gives opportunities, potentially including alliances with Timur directly. You know, and Timur, after all, it's not a coincidence that he ends up being written about by people like Shakespeare. You know, he becomes considered here in the West a kind of salvation figure that will save us from, you know, the great perils.
For those who haven't joined those particular dots, it's Tamerlane the Great. Not one of his greatest plays, but it is, that is Timur. That is, yeah, all about that man.
It's not one of his greatest plays, but on the other hand, I was quite surprised that I was in Cambridge the other day, came from the train station, there's the Tamerlane Hotel next to the... next to the train station. And I'm sort of quite pleased by that in a way.
Yeah, you can check in, but you can never leave.
That's it. Central Asian style.
That's it.
The Genghis Khan Hotel.
Don't go there. Don't go there, Peter.
To smash the glass.
Stick to Oxford.
So, you know, I think that that reshuffling of the decks in other parts of the world, you know, we forget how interconnected these worlds all are. And, you know, again, going back to my Byzantine, you know, my field of vision sitting in Constantinople in the periods I particularly work on, you know, does really include sources from Iceland, from Portugal and Spain, from North Africa, from sub-Saharan Africa, right the way through the Himalayas into South Asia and even into China now. You know, we're finding lots of artifacts made in the Byzantine world, lots of exchange. So this kind of globalized connections, and of course, up to Scandinavia and down into Ethiopia, and in fact, even further south. So these kind of ways in which the jigsaw is constantly moving means that, you know, you're never quite a master of your destiny. What the Byzantines do very well, and in fact what Timur does quite well, what the Mongols do quite well, is to be constantly balancing different powers. You know, I spend a lot of time in Central Asia today, and there, you know, in a neighborhood where you've got Russia in the north, China in the east, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan to the south, Iran, you know, you're in quite a complicated neighborhood. And that requires you to be exactly the same thing that the Byzantines did, which is to gather information, to be multilingual, to be highly adaptable, to be able to measure threats and risks carefully. And, you know, I suppose the starting point with the Byzantines is, you know, were they unlucky and they ran out of steam in 1453 eventually, or maybe they could have even made it through that if it wasn't for a particular set of circumstances that I think you'll talk about in the next episode. Is it possible that, in fact, Constantinople had hung on and perhaps things could have turned out differently? A bit like the Ottomans very, very nearly unlocked the gates of Vienna twice, in fact. And if that had happened, maybe things would have looked slightly different. So, in fact, in a new book that I've just finished, the way in which the Ottomans moved into Europe and put Vienna under pressure was hugely influential in what it did for the Reformation, hugely influential in the spread of Martin Luther's ideas, and hugely influential in stopping military conflict between European powers. So these kind of jigsaw pieces that are reacting to each other are really important and fascinating to be looking at and studying.
So just before we leave this, just let's have a vision of the world in 1450. What's going on in Byzantium? What's going on with the Ottoman Turks? We last saw the poor Bayezid, the Sultan Bayezid, in a cage, captured by Timur after the Battle of Ankara, banging his head against the bars of his cage, a captive. He can't even stand up. How do we go from there to imminent Ottoman capture of Constantinople?
Well, you know, every film needs a Luke Skywalker. You know, every clash of empires needs the hero to enter from stage left. And just before 1450, in the Ottoman world, it's Mehmed who becomes known as the Conqueror.
Who's a kid? He's, what, 19 when he comes to power?
Yeah, but Michael Owen was only 18 when he scored that goal against Argentina in the World Cup in 1998.
And that's exactly the same. Yes, you're right. No, you're right. Of course you're right.
Look, age is something slightly different. I mean, it's interesting with Mehmed. I mean, we historians were very reluctant to talk about sort of the great man or great woman school of history, you know, it's on the shoulders of one person for very obvious reasons. But the world that Mehmet finds himself at the top of as a young, ambitious, clever, sophisticated, well-educated young man is one where he has been trained to how to think about other people's strategic weaknesses and what his strengths are. And, you know, you can know yourself quite well if you've had the right kind of upbringing. But clearly the institutions that he's sitting on top of are highly invested behind that kind of leadership for it to work. So the military structure, the economy, the religious authorities, there's a full armed Death Star. I know that's mixing my Luke Skywalkers with the goodies, the baddies. But, you know, the Ottomans are all ready to go, but they're in search of an inspirational, brilliant leader. And he is the right man at the right time for the right job. I mean, as I said, would it have mattered if they just carried on bypassing Constantinople for decades, centuries? You know, could it have been a free port, free city? I mean, the truth is that the gains that were offered by Constantinople by this time are pretty modest. It's economically shriveled, much lower population than at its peak. It's no longer an important trade hub as it once was.
It's gone from, what, a million in the 12th century to about 50,000.
Well, I'd probably have it a half million, probably half that size in the 12th century. And I'd probably have it, yeah, about 50,000, I suppose. But what that doesn't tell you is that what has also happened in that period is that more trade has started to come up through the Red Sea and to reach Europe through different means. The 1450s are a hugely significant moment in Iberian exploration of the coasts of Africa that opens up gold, opens up new goods, new products, and sets the scene for slavery that then becomes institutional, transatlantic, and mass million. But so I think that world of Constantinople is a shadow, but only a shadow of the past, in the same way that, you know, London isn't an imperial capital as it once was, but that there's no shame in that. But Mehmed is the key part in working out how to finally solve the problem of taking control of Constantinople, which is symbolically hugely significant that the great city of Rome finally falls and to Mehmed himself.
Well, I mean, you have, if Mehmed is the key, Constantinople is the lock, you have absolutely beautifully teed us up for the next episode. Peter Frankopan, that was a tour de force, and we are so very grateful, really, so, so grateful. And thank you very much. And when the new book comes out, we've got dibs on you.
Peter, thank you so, so much.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, that is quite brilliant. And unfortunately, that's all we have time for today on the Empire Pod. So what have these very lovely people got to look forward to next week, Willie?
It's one of the great stories of history. It's the moment that the Ottomans capture Constantinople. And as I say, it's also my favourite history book.
Why did you blow the ending again? It is the one where the butler did it. It's the one where they all died at the end. It's the one.
It was the lead pipe. It was the lead pipe.
The children got away with it because, you know, you do it every time. Anyway, yes. So we will see you then. Until then, it's goodbye from me, Anita Arnon.
And it's goodbye from me, William Dalrymple.
Sag mal, hast du bei der Steuer auch diesen Schulflashback? Einfach irgendwas raten und dann hoffen, dass es stimmt?
Boah, nee, gar nicht. Wieso, Steuer ist so mein Safe Space.
Du meinst, damit ist alles sicher?
Ja, genau. Wieso, Steuer ist so die Steuer-App, die dich einfach versteht. Egal ob Studium, Job oder Umzug.
Stimmt, krass. Fühlt sich gar nicht wie Steuern an.
Steuern erledigt?
Safe.
Mit Wieso, Steuer.
Du kümmerst dich jeden Tag um andere, um dich und um dein Zuhause. Du kümmerst dich, wenn es drauf ankommt. Und weil du dich kümmerst, kümmern wir uns um das Geld, das du dafür brauchst, damit Kredit so einfach wird wie noch nie. Hol auch du dir jetzt deinen Kredit auf auxmoney.com. Auxmoney. Kredit einfach online.